And now another no-brainer money-saving tip from Progressive.
Marcus, what happened?
I was changing my oil and I spilled some on the floor.
Oh, well, use these $50 bills to wipe it up.
Perfect. Got any more?
Yeah, take a couple hundred.
Stop. Instead of using money, use an old rag. And here's a better tip from Progressive on how not to waste money. Don't pay too much for car insurance. Drivers who switch and save could save hundreds. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Potential savings will vary.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Ancient Warfare Podcast. My name is Jasper Worthaus. I'm the editor of Ancient Warfare Magazine. And with me today are Mark McCaffrey, Lindsay Powell, Murray Dom, and Mark DeSantis. And it's an in-betweener, as we say. So that means we pick a random topic. And we decided this time we'd talk about our favorite ancient military sources. And why? So I guess what we'll just do is I'll just point at someone, even though you can't see it, but and it won't even make sense for them because I'm pointing at a screen. It could be any of them. and we'll see what comes up. Mark DeSantis, I think you said you prepped several. So how about you do the one that we know about or the surprise that you pick?
I chose Arian because his history of Alexander's campaign, I think, it's one of the first pieces of ancient military history that I read, and it's one of the first that I ever studied in depth and researched with it. And I think that in terms of its narrative flow, its overall quality, I think it's very, very high. It's extremely good. And I think that while every work emanating from the ancient world has its flaws, I think this one got across, at least, I think a believable picture of Alexander. Once again, not to say that we take everything at face value simply because Arian presented it to us, but I think Arian was a capable historian who was able to himself take the sources that he had and turn it into a coherent narrative history of his own. Further, as a military historian, I think that he is of a great deal of value. And I think that comes from the fact that Arian himself was a soldier in the sense that he commanded, from what we understand, as governor of Cappadocia, Roman military forces that were used to expel invading Alans from within the frontiers of the Roman Empire sometime in the early second century. And I think that having real world military experience probably helped him write his history of Alexander. So I would say for me, it's Arian. I also would like to put forward, he's not a military historian, but, and I think that it'll still be a surprising choice, but St. Augustine, writing at the end of the period of the Western Roman Empire, so roughly the early 5th century AD, makes several references, multiple references to ancient Roman events, military events. And he does it primarily with the purpose of showing how the military disasters or setbacks that the Roman Empire of the 5th century AD was experiencing were in no way worse than what had befallen the pagan republic of, say, the second or first centuries BC. And leaving aside that aspect of his history, I think it's interesting to see how St. Augustine was able to reach back 5-6 centuries in time and bring forward, for instance, the Goths had sacked Rome recently in 410 AD, and he was really able to go back and point out various things that had happened in Roman history, which it's for him to say that the Goths of Alaric were not nearly as bad as, say, earlier disasters. Calamities that had befallen the Romans were much worse. Also, So I think the important point to bring out here is that Augustine had access to and knowledge of all of these events, which for us, they would probably be at the distance of, say, the Battle of Pavia or Marignano in the early 16th century, or even Agincourt. So I think it shows that an educated person of the Roman Empire had this at his fingertips. And so apart from talking about what had happened in the Roman Republic, the civil wars, for instance, he also made mention of how Carthage, the fall of Carthage, was a bad thing for Roman morals. That is, they had an enemy that kept them, I think, tough. And once Carthage was gone, they started to decline. He makes mention of Marcus Atilius Regulus, who had been apparently taken prisoner by the Carthaginians. Now, whether or not the story was actually true, that once he had gone back, he then said, you know, I'll go back to Carthage as I swore that I would. But it's a piece of history that was at least he was aware of. So I think that St. Augustine is worth a look, the early books especially, just to see what a Roman intellectual of the late empire might have actually thought of ancient military historical events.
Do you have a specific, when you say Arian, do you have a translation in mind?
my translation was the first one I ever came across was the Penguin translation. So it's the Aubrey de Salincourt translation. I happen to enjoy it. I'm not going to say that other translations aren't just as good, but the his translation, de Salincourt, was the one that I've had for decades now, so going on over 30 years.
And his access to sources, of course, is one of the other reasons why he's so great, because, you know, he's reading Ptolemy, and we can't read Ptolemy, and he's reading XYZ, and we can't read XYZ, we can only read Arian.
Most of the histories of Alexander, the original histories, actually, I would say anything written, you know, even near his lifetime are gone. So we were forced to rely upon someone like Arian, who at least had access to them, and I think that's why he's very valuable.
Well, even Plutarch, really. You know, you look at Plutarch, and he's not writing history. He tells us he's not writing history, and yet still most people use him as a historian with a single sentence at the start going, well, he was writing biography, and that's it. You're like, surely that has something to do with why he's, you know, not telling us what any other source tells us, because perhaps he, you know, didn't have the same set of rules, you know, but again, he had material that we can't possibly read, which is, you know, makes him all the more valuable.
You bring up a wonderful question. Why would it be that the history as written by Ptolemy disappeared? He's not the only monarch that ever had a history that disappeared. I think Claudius, the Emperor Claudius, penned at least two, one on Carthage and one on the Etruscans, both all gone.
I don't know, Mark. I think estimates are that about 2% or something like that of
ancient... You're being generous there. Typically here 1%, isn't it, that survives from ancient...
So the default is it disappeared. You don't have to find anything suspicious about it. It's just like...
Yeah, gone.
Well, I like the fact that the greatest surviving, like, in terms of quantity, it's Galen. And then you read, like, it's some enormous proportion of what survives from the ancient world. Like 37% is Galen's writings. You're like,
and is that because it was of practical value? And
well, he's the greatest doctor of his age. You know, he's the
person. He did write physician. A lot.
Yeah, he did. He wrote a lot. He's a kind of a Cicero of the Antonine era. He was the personal physician of Marcus Aurelius. So quite amazing.
If you're a medieval monk, that's useful, right? You want to be able to have actionable, useful material.
Yeah. So, you know, and, you know, he describes the plague, for instance, in Rome in the 160s. So it's quite remarkable what he does. But then, you know, there's so much we would just swap it out for in a heartbeat.
There's a great deal of St. Augustine that has survived too. So,
City of God is City of God is quite large.
Lindsay, what's your favorite?
I've chosen Cassius Dio, and I think the reason is because it's the longest consistent sort of chronicle of Roman history. And apart from that, it's a sort of encyclopedia of interesting facts interweaved into sort of long narrative sections of history. It's how, for example, we know the deployment of the Roman legions, for example, under Augustus. And even though it's influenced by his own day, he's writing at the time of the Severan emperors, it's very useful to have that sort of thing. We only have another one, which is Tacitus's account, which is writing for a few years later. And he tells us about, for example, how the Roman watch, the night watch, came into being. And all these sorts of details are superimposed into a text, which is a chronicle. So it begins with the consuls are elected for the year, so you know exactly which year you're talking about, and there are a whole series of events, and characters come and go, and some of them have played, like, for example, Julius Caesar, obviously towering figures in the narrative, or Augustus, and various other people. And basically, he's writing from the foundation of the city, 753 BC, to his own day in the early 200s AD. So it's a vast span. Now, of course, a lot of the volumes don't survive. I think he wrote 142 of them, and I think there's only about 35 or something like that actually survive. We only know about the contents of some of them because of these, effectively, their library tags called the Perioeci, which have sort of short summaries of what was in there. So we know that the last of these books, I think, I'm confusing it with Livy. So I've been reading Livy today. So scrap
John,
all that bit.
John Zephyrlinus. The summaries of Zephyrlinus and Zonaras.
Yes, so we have him that sort of praises and summarizes some of the things, which is confusing because we're not quite sure how much he praises and what is actually authentically the voice of Cassius Dio. So anyway, so I like him very much because from me writing biographies of Augustus and his commanders, it's wonderful to have a pretty consistent historical structure in which to track these people's lives and events. Interposed with these wonderful little details, like I said about, you know, the deployment of the Roman army or the building of like the Pantheon or whatever the structure might well be. And it's interposed with his invented speeches for different people in the traditional style of Roman history. But it's all written in Greek, of course, not Latin. So if you're looking for the Loeb classics, you'll find it in the green covers, not the red ones. There are several volumes, in fact, because there are so many that are covered in that. But it's fairly easy reading. It's not sort of literature, and it's not terribly dense. But if you like facts and you like sort of trying picking together campaigns, and when I wrote my Augustus at War, what was amazing to me was how thorough he was in presenting that there was this war in this theater and this war in that theater. And occasionally he'd get very bored of it and say, lots of wars happened this period, nothing of interest to report. And then the following year, and you did what? Yeah, sort of editorial red pen right through the whole of a year or two or three, added to which you get these lacunae in the actual the missing documents. So that's very frustrating because you don't know, you know, whole tracts of history and why they worked the way they did. But so Cassius Dio, I highly recommend him. And my sort of surprise recommendation would be Velleius Paterculus, simply because he was actually a serving commander, soldier, certainly a person of military experience in a way that Cassius Dio probably was not. Cassius Dio was an administrator, a senator for his career. But it's very clear that what he was doing, Paterculus, in writing his Roman history, was, again, he was trying to write a long period of history, but it's only in two books. So compare that with, you know, hundreds of books for 80 books, like 80 books for Cassius Dio and just two for Velleius Paterculus. And he's often rubbished by modern scholars because he tends to, because of the time he served under Tiberius, who eventually became emperor, he sort of was a little bit awestruck. So you get the sense that maybe he's writing a version of history which really puts Tiberius in this wonderful glow of achievement, and he is the chosen one in some respects. I think that's overstated. I think if you actually read what he actually writes, it's pretty factual. It's pretty straightforward. And yes, there are some sort of high praises of Tiberius. But it's also how we get to learn how, for example, in the battlefield, Tiberius had his litter ready for wounded troops so that his litter and his physician was available to help wounded soldiers because he saw it. And that was the sort of detail that would probably get lost in a Cassius Dio. Or, for example, there's a beautiful moment where in 84, where Verus Paterculus is actually part of the entourage going with Tiberius to the German frontier, where Paterculus will take over his assignment as praefectus. And on the way, as they're going through the camps, he records this passage where the soldiers say, "Is that you, Tiberius? I served with you in Pannonia, or I served with you in this place or that place." And again, these are little kind of cameo moments which really personalize history, I think, because he was the witness of them. And it's not often you actually see that in a written history, because those people are relying on written documents. He's relying on his experience as well as written documents. So I think it's very compelling for that reason.
Of course, he doesn't just discuss the history that he actually experienced himself. I mean, he goes way back. When does he start?
I think the Trojan War, actually. Yeah, it goes back to the Trojan War.
He goes through some of the earlier stuff very quickly, and then, but it's more or less complete, isn't it?
Yes, as far as I understand, it mostly is. And most of it really is down from the period of Julius Caesar's assassination to Augustus, and then finally it's the early years of Tiberius's reign. And what would be very interesting, because he's living at the time of Sejanus, so he sees those two working as a co-regents is not the right word, but working in as colleagues, and it's not yet apparent the wickedness that Sejanus is inflicting on the Republic. So it would be very interesting, had he lived a few more years and written about to the end of Tiberius, whether his glowing sort of praise, really sort of portraying Tiberius as this very accomplished successor to Augustus, carrying on the task, the best qualified man in the world to do it sort of thing, all the while being duped by Sejanus. You know, I mean, this is not really something that's covered in there, but it's straightforward reading. It's not terribly hard. A lot of people, I think, that use it to actually learn Latin, because the Latin isn't that hard or literary. For that reason, a lot of people kind of downplay him, because, as I say, it's not terribly sophisticated. But I look at it, he's a soldier. He's trained as a military man. And you can imagine someone used to writing reports and after-action reports wouldn't be a literate sort of person writing flowery language, and he doesn't.
You know, one of the when you mentioned the glossing over of Cassius Dio of various wars that were taking place at certain points in time. I mean, one of the most frustrating parts of Polybius is when he's discussing the latter years of the First Punic War, where Hamilcar Barca is fighting the Romans, and he talks about all of the stratagems that makes passing reference to them, but he doesn't bother to actually tell you any of the real details of what was going. He just says that they were all, all sorts of fighting, ambushes, and things like that. I would have loved to know what was going on in Sicily with Hamilcar Barca's troops fighting the Romans, and what he did, because Hamilcar was clearly a brilliant general in his own right, with a wonderful reputation, and he had the loyalty of his soldiers under the most trying of circumstances. What did he do that he managed to keep the Romans at bay for all of those years? And he was never defeated in the field. He was told to evacuate Sicily. He was never defeated by the Romans.
This is the kind of thing that the Romans don't want you to know.
The thing about the interesting about Paterculus is, because he's one of the sources for the disaster of AD 9 in Teutoburg. And because he'd served within that geography, I mean, it's very interesting to read his kind of account as well. And he singles out individuals for praise, which again, we thrive on the details, the minutiae of combat and warfare and so on. And that's the sort of source I relish studying, because you get these things in there where someone like a Cassius Dio, if it's not in the chronicle or the official documentation, he's probably not going to know about it. And I'm sure he leaned heavily into Livy and Tacitus as well as his sources. Paterculus is, I think, an underrated historian.
It would have been very nice if Pliny's store histories of the Germanic wars had survived, because, again, served in that war at the same, slightly later, probably.
I think slightly later. Yeah. Yes. And in fact, he is a source that Tacitus actually quotes him. As a source for some of his statistics or facts. And in fact, his nephew, Pliny the Younger, of course, actually lists his book, the All the Wars in Germany or something, which tells us again that we don't know that very much or about many of them. So when people try and write sort of authoritative histories, we've got to remember that, in the sense where the lucky but unfortunate victims of editorial decisions by these ancient historians. I mean, they've decided to include or not include, and we don't know what they miss half the time.
Mark, what is your favorite source?
My favorite? I've got two that I was going to mention. One, which is, I think there'd be some people who argue he's not necessarily a military source, but I would go with Cicero for, you know, the go-to source of the first century BC. He is a brilliant source, and even though he's not necessarily focusing on warfare in a century that's focused on, you know, civil war after civil war, the personalities that come into play in those civil wars are really brought to life by Cicero's writings. Now, of course, Cicero writes in terms of, we've got his legal speeches, we've got his philosophical treatises. But I would say the most important literature to come out of Cicero, or the most interesting, is actually in terms of the letters. And that's letters to, in particular, Atticus, who's his lifelong friend, who a millionaire playboy who resides most of the time in Greece and needs to be brought up to speed a lot of the time. But at the same time, family and friends in general. We've got such a wide scope there of the important players in Rome during Cicero's lifetime. Now, of course, the letters, they don't necessarily go throughout his entire career. They're collected at the end of his career, we're told, possibly by Tiro, his secretary slave most of his career. The collection that as they exist only really start in 62 BC onwards. So therefore it sort of misses his climb to in politics up to the consulship in 63. But at the same time, it's sort of the contents of those letters then proceed to sort of cover the fallout from his consular year. And one of my favorite topics, the Catiline conspiracy and that sort of thing. But it sort of brings to life, on the one hand, those characters who you sort of get mentioned in the histories who you don't really get filled out, you know, because they're under the shadow of Caesar or Pompey. But at the same time, you get little snapshots of dealings with those greats. And again, it's like Lindsay was saying, it's those little, you know, snapshots of a little bit of personal experience and personal interaction with these people that Cicero, and at the same time, I think the fun thing is that you sort of read Cicero and you're just at the same time trying to work out he's very human, and you got it, and you can sort of see the, you know, the political workings of his words in terms of how is he trying to deal with each of these individuals, who is he trying to play to their personalities and their foibles. Is Cicero, you know, does he go, you know, pleading to Pompey at times, or is he trying to play Pompey at times? It's something that you can come back to time and time again. With each new reading, you sort of get that little bit more, you know, another sort of question in your mind as you go through. So I think it's, you know, something that you come back to time and time again. At the same time, you get those little snapshots of personalized life and the details of Roman life, like, for example, you know, his addressing of little Tullia, his daughter, in the letters. You've got the references to his wife, Terentia, and her support, financial and otherwise, during his exile in 58. It's those little details that sort of come through and help us to sort of understand the political workings of Rome and what's behind some of the family dynamics and the personal dynamics that are behind politics in that first century. So I'd say Cicero and his letters would be a real must in terms of understanding the military workings of Rome in that century. The second one, going against what Mark said, I would be going with Quintus Curtius for a history of Rome. History of Augustus. Alexander. too many topics. In terms of Alexander, it is. In terms of Alexander, yes, we've sort of got these sources that are all produced after the fact. There's, you know, secondhand in terms of they are utilizing sources that have disappeared. Quintus Curtius is the Roman source written in Latin. And he is, of course, also, he's influenced by his own literary world. And he is, after that, you know, he's basing himself on that model of Livy and trying to deliver a history of Alexander. But at the same time, it flows that much more. And okay, it's, sometimes some of it can be called into question in certain aspects, and you go to the other sources and there's that disagreement. But at the same time, it gives a good running narrative of Alexander's campaigns, albeit not complete, because of course you're missing the first two books, and also you've got a bunch of different lacunae throughout as you go through. But still, I think if you want a good narrative of Alexander from the primary sources, that would be my preference.
I think it's interesting with Curtius. I was criticized for relying too much on Curtius Rufus, but the fact of the matter is that he provides detail which looks entirely credible, and the detail that he provides is coincidentally in the spots where Arrian and Plutarch don't provide it. So, you know, when you take it in
it's got that bit more logic to it, really.
And when you take it in combination with them, you can be more balanced.
Yeah. I mean, as you say, it has been unpopular in various circles over the years. It does bring in, you know, some of the more fanciful stories about Alexander at times, things like the Gordian Knot, for example. But at the same time, it does, I think, deliver a consistent character of Alexander throughout.
I agree with you on Cicero. I think it's marvelous that we actually have a witness and a participant in events to the point where you can actually say to the day and sometimes the hour of the day. And the one thing I think we're all envious of modern historians is with access to letters and film footage and newspapers and all the rest of it, is they can very precisely chronicle things and they can put them on a chronology. And the thing we struggle with all the time is actually trying to actually precisely align things in ancient history. You know, I mean, again, to take the guy I picked, I mean, Cassius Dio will make some assessments based on what he knows. And I was looking at recently, I was just doing something about Hannibal today. And in fact, it was Cornelius Fronto actually admits that even when he was writing, there were three different estimates as the year in which Hannibal died. How could he have three different years, right? So, but that's the problem that we have as ancient historians. So when you look at Cicero, when you have that precision and the authenticity of a voice, you can forgive him that he saved the Republic and did all the other things. And he had a horrible end, of course. So you know, it already ended miserably. But we have his letters. We have his writings. It's great.
His value also can be judged by what we're missing as well, because I always think it's interesting in terms of the inclusions in the collection of letters, that one notable exception, which we know he corresponded with greatly, is, of course, the young Augustus, Octavian. And, of course, those letters are deliberately not there.
I find it interesting when you look at modern historians and they've got video footage and they still don't know what's going on. And I think, you know, one of the things that surprises a lot of young people when you're talking about being a historian is the ease with which an ancient historian says, we don't know. We just don't know. And they're like, but you're a historian. How can you not know? It's like, because the sources don't tell us. And as a historian, we need to stop speculating at a certain point and go, you know, this is where we're in the realm of historical fiction, not speculative history. And they're always gobsmacked because, you know, and I tell them, the two examples I use are, you know, Kennedy's assassination. It was filmed and we still don't know what happened. Or, you know, that kind of idea that if you have a divorce and you ask one party what happened and you have the other party, you're going to get two very, very different accounts of what went on the same set of events. And, you know, it's not a lawsuit in the sense that, you know, as a historian, you're not a judge in terms of which is the truth, but in a way, you are saying this is what happened, and you're not doing the here's one side, here's the other. You're doing the combined, this is what happened, and we do the whole, whereas this source says this, and this source has an alternative view and does this instead.
And you know, and the wonderful thing is the grandfather, the father of history, Herodotus, knew that. which is why he went out and actually got witness testimony, actually got people, and he recognized that people didn't see the same things the same way, which is marvelous. So in a sense, written history starts with the man who recognized that fundamental problem.
One of our patrons actually wrote in just because we put out the question, and this actually does make for a segue to you, Murray, because he says that his favorite is Aeneas Tacticus, because he thinks it's interesting because he wrote essentially the first how-to book in history. Defending a Greek city is interesting in how you organize both the citizens and the mercenaries, and it falls into that interesting pre-Hellenistic Greek period. Pre- and post-Hellenistic new dating system. But Murray wrote about this in Ancient Warfare a long time ago.
A long, long time ago. Well, that was my first master's degree back in 1992. Was looking at the, what did I call it?
It wasn't that long ago that you wrote for ancient history, though.
No. The genre of ancient didactic military literature, which is a very niche genre, even to this day, despite my best efforts to make it far more better known. And my two favorite sources are from within that genre, not surprising.
What a surprise.
Aeneas Tacticus is fascinating because we have How to Survive a Siege, which is written, we think, in the 450s, sorry, the 350s BC, because he doesn't mention Philip of Macedon. So he must be writing before he comes to the fore. And he writes seven other books that we know of, because he mentions them in his own one surviving book. Oh, I wrote this one. I'm going to write this one in the future, which is fascinating as well. In that period in the 360s BC, where there seems to be a whole bunch of authors writing, this is how you should do things, mostly Aeneas Tacticus is surviving, but of course Xenophon as well. And Xenophon's fascinating. I have a very difficult relationship with Xenophon. One of the fascinating things about Xenophon, of course, is that we have everything Xenophon wrote complete and almost unique in the ancient world, that we have an author where we know all of their writings and we have all of Xenophon. And weirdly for Xenophon, you know, who's the only author from 411 BC down to 360 BC. He's a continuous historical narrative in the Hellenica. I unfortunately think that most of the time he's giving us Xenophon's version of events, which is not particularly what was going on, but that's okay. But he's not who I want to talk about. And he and Aeneas Tacticus, of course, are writing these sort of how-to books, and that's where the genre begins and then takes off under Alexander and after. I was going to follow what Mark DeSantis said about, you know, the Penguin translation of Arrian. My first exposure to ancient history was the Penguin translation of Herodotus, and that really made me fall in love with Herodotus. And if there was any ancient author I would pick up to read for fun, it would be Herodotus. At the same time, as a military historian, you know, considering he wrote the histories and it's about the Persian Wars, there's so much in the histories that's not about the Persian Wars. And, you know, you get to the end of book six and you're like, oh, here comes the Battle of Marathon. It's the linchpin. And, you know, eight chapters, you're like, is that it? What? There's so many questions about what we don't know. And then, you know, and then you get to the later books and you've got the same kind of, we don't really know what happened after reading that. And yet it was fascinating and fun the whole time, which is, you know, and then you read all the alternatives and you're like, I still don't know what happened. Gosh. Anyway, so my favorite two authors are from this genre, and they are the only two surviving collections of stratagems from the ancient world. One written by Sextus Julius Frontinus in probably about 87 AD, and the other by Polyaenus of Macedon, written in between 161 and 162 AD. So it's this entire genre of ancient literature, which we think begins in the Hellenistic period after Alexander the Great. None of those examples survive. We've got several works named by the amazing bibliophile from the Byzantine area, Photius, who has this huge list of books that he recommends to his brother, which he gives us this very brief précis of, which is a fascinating source in itself, generally because when we do have the book surviving, his précis is very accurate. So for the books that we don't have surviving, which is most of them, we kind of go, well, Photius tells us that he said this, that's useful. So we have all these lists about, and frustrating, we have all these lists of other stratagem collections, none of which survive. So we have these two collections of stratagems. Frontinus is, again, fascinating because he's one of the most successful generals of the first century AD, and yet no one's ever heard of his name. He begins his career under Claudius and then serves every emperor without break, which is fascinating in itself, because he serves Vespasian, he serves Domitian, he serves Nerva, and he serves Trajan without anyone going, hang on a minute, you were loyal to the last regime, we're not employing you anymore, which is what most people in the first century AD have at some point. And, you know, because he served, well, before that, he served Nero. So, you know, Claudius, Nero, the four emperors, then he's, you know, just amazing. And he commands in various different places, which is fascinating in itself. And then he writes down a science of military knowledge, a De Re Militari, which is lost, although we think Vegetius, when he's writing in the 4th century AD, uses Frontinus. And then at the beginning of the Stratagems, he says, since I've written that, and we're like, no, it's lost, I'm going to write down a whole bunch of anecdotes to illustrate the examples of science, the military science that I've written. And of course, one of the fascinating things about stratagems, you don't get any of the theory. You just get the example. So they don't say, you know, this illustrates chapter 7 of what I was talking about. They just go, here's something that a general did. Here's something that a general did. So Frontinus has 500 stratagems, which are mostly Roman. There are some Greek ones. The frustrating thing for me is that these collections are generally plundered for the historical information that they provide that other sources don't. So there are several battles, Chaeronea probably being the most interesting one, where the stratagem collections are the ones that give us the best picture because the historical sources don't survive for that battle. And at the same time, there are stratagems that contradict our known sources or that give you the opposite action in a particular situation. You're surrounded by the enemy. Oh, well, we surrender. Or, no, we fight our way out. You're like, okay, well, which one is the better one? And they don't give any judgment on that. They just go, in this situation, this is what this general did. So that's fascinating for me because there's some kind of practical body to it. And Frontinus is, you know, vastly experienced as a military historian. I'm getting all choked up because I'm not getting emotional about my historians, but I'm you know, literally joking. So Polyaenus is the opposite of Frontinus. He is a lawyer. He's an advocate for Marcus Aurelius. And the fascinating thing at the beginning of Marcus Aurelius's reign, of course, is we've had the reigns of Hadrian and Antoninus Pius, who haven't led armies in person. And the last emperor to lead an army in person is Trajan in his Parthian campaign in around 117 AD. And at the beginning of Marcus Aurelius's reign, he immediately adopts his brother Lucius Verus as a co-emperor. There's wars everywhere. And, you know, there's a war in Britain, there's a war in Parthia, there's a war in Spain, there's a war on the German frontier, there's a war on the Danube frontier, there's a war in Africa. It's like everyone took their opportunity to rebel against Roman rule at that point. So they have to serve all of these wars. And Lucius Verus decides he's going to lead the Parthian War in person. And this is like the gold standard literary event of that period. Every writer writes something for the emperors to read about what's going to happen. And of course, they're all wanting to get their own job out of it. And Polyaenus is one of those who survives. And so he tells us that he's writing a set of stratagems, 900 stratagems going back to mythology, and he does them ethnographically, which is fascinating in itself. Like he has the fourth book is the book of Macedonian stratagems. So he only looks at the Macedonians. Book 7 is the barbarian stratagem. So he only looks at barbarians, which is interesting division by itself. And he has more stratagems than Frontinus, but he's also one of these armchair historians who's, you know, he never saw a battlefield. And he's compiling from various different sources. You get people abusing him for being a cut and paste author. But at the same time, he's got access to sources we don't have. There's lots of anecdotes which don't survive otherwise in other histories. And he gives us massive amounts of insight into not only the genre that he's writing in, but also the literary environment in which he was writing. Because otherwise we have Lucian's How to Write History, which basically starts with an abuse of all of these other historians who are writing for Lucius Verus and their crimes against history that they write, you know, and how appallingly bad they are. And, you know, we have all these sort of names of works which were being addressed to Lucius Verus and Marcus Aurelius, but they don't survive. And we have this one example, which I don't put in the same category because, you know, he's already in front of the emperors at Rome. He writes before the campaign departs for the East, whereas most of these other ones are chasing the Lucius Verus's court around the East, trying to get attention. So that, you know, in addition to the military history value that you've got in the source material, they both offer incredibly interesting insights into imperial careers and how you can, you know, advance yourself and what you were capable of doing. So,
cool.
What about yours, Jasper?
I'll just add one because we're getting on. I think he's been called that boring old fart on Roman Army Talk once. Vegetius, of course, the epitome of military science. I mean, he is both fascinating and frustrating in equal measure, I think. He's just full of stuff, facts about what the army should be like, was like, or is, how sieges should be conducted. And for my particular interest, first time I met him was reading about what he says about naval warfare, which consists about half of it is about what you should do to make sure that there's no storm and predict the wind and the weather, which is very sensible when you're going out to sea in fragile ships, but it doesn't teach you very much about naval warfare. But, and I remember many, many discussions on Roman Army Talk, and lots of ink has been poured over this. All these details that are in Vegetius and nowhere else. It's like, is this adaptable? Is this pertinent to this topic? Does it make any sense at all? Where did he get it from? Is it a 4th century thing? Is it maybe 2nd century BC that he got it from? It is like a grab bag of all kinds of details that pop up everywhere. I mean, if you see, well, we were talking about ospreys before we started the recording. You know, in any osprey, you see a Roman naval soldier, he'll be wearing blue. That's from Vegetius. You know, never mind that Vegetius talks about a very particular use by the British fleet in reconnaissance missions that might or may not be wearing blue. I mean, there's articles about that too, that it's not actually blue. It may be the Venetian blue of the sports team. Never mind. That's where it comes from. And all these details, what's it from? What is he saying? It's like, it is so interesting to read. And it's like every single sentence you can try and find, where is it from? And can I use it? Is it useful for what I'm researching or not? And it actually gets me to something that, and I asked Mark in the beginning, what translation do you use? And, you know, because that's really, it's a very relevant question when you're going to discuss any source. Are you going to read it in the original Latin or Greek? You know, is that something that you can do? Are you able to do that? Are you going to get all the nuances? And then can you get a really good translation and preferably an edited translation that gives you references? Like, I mean, I've got this Vegetius here, and it has lots of footnotes to say, look, this might come from here. This is, you know, paralleled by this source, by that source. And Arian, I think, has appeared in the Landmark Historian. Carlos, watching live, says, what about Julius Caesar, the Gallic Wars? Yes, of course, it's compelling for everyone to read. I think you're completely right. And again, Landmark Historians, absolutely the text to read it with, probably, because it puts the same with Cicero's letters. I was thinking, you know, you can read Cicero's letters, but it's very helpful if you've got a lot of context at your fingertips. Who are these people? What role are they playing at the time he's writing to them or about them? It is lovely to read text like Herodotus just by himself. He's just fun. But if you can read him with a good good source text with lots of maps, so you can know where are we now, what are we talking about, what is reflected in other texts. That just makes it a lot of extra fun to be your own historian a bit.
To your point, Jasper, somebody was asking you about Caesar's Gallic War. J. Arnold in Illinois, USA. I've been tweeting, by the way, as we've been talking. He writes, Caius Julius Caesar, his unabashed self-promotion and, frankly, his relatively simple writing style that was a godsend to a second semester classics major. So the Latin language is important in this.
Omnia Gallia tre partes. Yes, yes.
Yes. And as Velez Paterculus, not very complicated, Tacitus apparently is.
No. Anabasis 1, isn't it, for Greek? Isn't that right, Mark? Anabasis 1
is
notorious example. But I think one of the things about Vegetius, of course, is that his name, there's a debate. Who he was writing for, there's a debate. Yeah. When he was writing, there's a debate.
Yeah.
It's like, can we get past the first word of the... No, we've got to settle these. And the fascinating thing about those debates, of course, is that there is no settling them because they're open.
Everything is just, it's circular questions. Because it all comes from him.
I think you can do that with any of the sources that we've talked about, though, in terms of, you know, as I said, someone as well-versed as Cicero and, you know, someone you think you know that source and you've got so much information about him, you can still, you know, tease out that little, you know, that little extract of, you know, how serious was he about this? You know, what was his real opinion? You know, is he, when he's talking about the first triumvirate as three-headed dog, or if he's talking about his suicidal thoughts when he's in Dyrrhachium, you know, it's still you've got a source there that's you're sort of thinking, is he playing to the crowd? Is he playing to his intended audience? Was he thinking that this would go out later on? Because of course he can, you know, he famously every one of his court cases, which he thought to, you know, he wanted to publish and get out there to a wider audience, etc. But at the same time, he'd go back and edit first before it appeared in print. You know, did he have a mind to posterity?
Didn't he come up with the statement, something along the lines, I paraphrase, I'm not worried about what people think about me today. It's 500 years from now I'm worried about.
Yeah, and that whole thing about, you know, that, and it's very early on his career. It keeps coming back when he goes to Sicily as governor and spends his time down there doing all these brilliant things, you know, lowering the grain prices for the common Roman and whatnot, sending back all of this correspondence. And again, that's prior to the 62 threshold, so therefore we don't have that correspondence. But he talks about all this correspondence that went back, and yet when he got back, coming back from Sicily, he arrives in not Naples, but Pozzuoli, getting off the ship, and someone walks up to him and says, so what's the news in Rome? And he says, I'm not coming from Rome. I'm coming from Sicily. Don't you know? And this friend of his says, no, I thought you were coming from Rome. Sorry, my mistake. And of course, Cicero realizes, oh, they weren't all talking about me after all. Therefore, I cannot leave Rome from now on. I must be where everybody can see me.
It's like the Facebook.
Facebook
of the ancient world. Have you not seen my updates? Have you not been following my story? Oh, come on! Did you not see my TikTok? It's like, no, I've been off social media, and it's like, you know, Cicero's world crumbles because no one's kept up with what he's been up to. I think there's a PhD in that. Social media.
Oh, good. I was looking
for Cicero's fragile ego.
So social media and Cicero.
Well, we really get into the absolute heart of the business of being an ancient historian here. You know, looking at the sources, finding the sources, and mostly running into the frustration of knowing that the sources did exist at one point, but are no longer accessible, or only somebody provides you with a tantalizing glimpse of what once may have been.
Or that horrible moment when the source actually burnt. And you've got that reference to Eumenes' tent going up in flames with the, you know, the daily accounts of Alexander's campaigns, and you're just crying as you sort of read that. But
that's why we thrive on it, isn't it? Because it's just endless in terms of its possibilities. And someone might yet find a scroll or an inscription, and who knows, answer all our questions.
well, one or two of them probably raise more than answer, unfortunately.
Oh, well, ancient history, it's more holes than it's like Swiss cheese.
Helvetian cheese, please.
Thank you very much again. We'll see you soon again. Bye-bye.